I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. In 2006, Massachusetts initiated major health care reforms. According to a Kaiser Family Foundation report, Massachusetts now has the lowest rate of uninsured residents in the country and a greater percentage of adults receiving preventative care. The Affordable Care Act, passed in 2010, aims to increase coverage and affordability of medical insurance to all Americans. But the question remains, why are we paying more for health care than other industrialized nations, but not any healthier? Joining us in our Woods Hole studio is Jim Purcell, former CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Rhode Island, who now facilitates the resolution of healthcare disputes. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
And joining us from WGBH in Boston is Professor Renee Landers. She's a director of Suffolk University Law School's Health and Biomedical Law Concentration. Good morning to you.
Oh, good morning.
So, Jim, let's start with the healthcare costs continuing to rise. Why?
Well, the news of the exchanges, both Massachusetts and under the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, I've always found that a little bit disrespectful. But the Affordable Care Act and the exchanges involve the distribution and financing of health care, but it doesn't get at the underlying cost of health care. And we continue to have a health care system that is designed to be paid for doing more rather than getting better results. We're changing slowly. We're starting the change, and we're on the cusp. It's taking much longer than even I thought. But until we get a system that pays for different things than doing more acts or performing more surgeries or seeing more office visits, we're going to get what we pay for, which is more volume, and that is one of the major drivers of costs. The other is patient responsibility. We have a whole untapped area there, and it may be an unpopular subject, which we can delve into later.
We will.
But that's an issue, too. But our system, our underlying delivery system has not changed to accommodate the increase in financing of healthcare.
Yeah. Renee, do you agree with that?
I do. I would also add that our system, you raised the comparison to the value that the people in other countries get for the dollars they spend on healthcare. And our system has embedded in it a lot of administrative costs that those other systems don't have because they are publicly administered programs. And so, you know, there are sort of lot fewer people in the pipeline from, you know, payment to delivery of care who are taking a piece of the action in those systems. And so that's another issue, the challenge of trying to reduce administrative costs. And the Affordable Care Act does have some provisions that try to address that concern, which is, you know, requiring health insurers to pay, to repay or give rebates to their subscribers if they don't spend, you know, certain levels on actual provision of health care services during a given year. And already, you know, millions of dollars have been paid in rebates across the country back to subscribers because of the insurance companies not meeting those. It's called a medical loss ratio, but not meeting those thresholds of paying for care.
So I think this is a question a lot of people have, is this whole costing, is where do our healthcare premium dollars go? So maybe we can break that down a little bit. Where
sure.
does it go?
If you talk about it, and Renee, you're absolutely right, although there would be one caveat I'd make, and I'll make it in the course of how I describe this. Your healthcare dollar, let's say this dollar premium for health insurance, maybe 3% of that goes to an insurer's profit, or if they're nonprofit, to their reserves. Another 12% goes to their administrative costs, but 85% is going to go to claims expense. So if you're really trying to impact the cost of health care, yes, as they say, every $1 million of costs count. Mm-hmm. And so you can't turn a blind eye toward insurer's profits or administrative costs, but the real money is in the care. Is in the 85%. And the 85% of care, let's try to make this as simple as we possibly can. It's divided up into two things, one of which are the fees you pay and the other which are the number of times you use the service. So if I take an office visit, if I pay $100 an office visit, that's the fee, but I may use two or three office visits. So you've got price, the fee, and utilization, the use. I don't think we're going backwards on the fees because the hospitals and doctors claim that insurers have too aggressively negotiated them down in their fees. You could argue with me on that or not, but I don't think you're going to see a lot of rollback on the fees. So what you're left with is the use. Mm. And we utilize too many services too inefficiently. And the key is, in terms of the reform of the delivery system, how do we create a delivery system that attacks the use of services in a way that is much smarter than what was done in the 1990s with HMOs, where, at least allegedly, they tried to prevent subscribers from getting needed health care? That's bad policy. It's bad medicine. I have views on what it is that we can do, and they're a little bit controversial, but you can't impact this intractable problem without being very, very disruptive.
Mm. Renee, what are your thoughts?
Well, I would agree that the overuse of some services is a problem. But along with that, we have a tremendous disparities in access to healthcare services. So we have, overutilization, as Jim was saying, on one hand, and then we have, whole populations in the country who don't have adequate access to just sort of basic, preventive, ordinary healthcare. In the short term, it's, solving the second problem is going to be a cost to the system. On the utilization side, I would say that that's a complicated question because it's not just how many office visits do you do, but, there have been studies that show that Americans actually go to the doctor, fewer times a year than people in other countries. But the question is, what happens when you go? How many tests are ordered? Are they the right tests? And so matching, the right level of use and ensuring quality, which is Jim also alluded to, that people have this concern that if we try to control on the cost side, that people will be denied care that they need. And that will totally undermine confidence in the system if people get that feeling.
Renee, I couldn't agree with you more. I think, first of all, office visits never break the bank. If a health insurer looks at its population, 5% of its insured population accounts for 55% of its claims expense. So what's really driving the dollar here are the chronic and acutely ill people. And the key is to keep the healthy healthy, to get services to those who don't get them currently so that they stay healthy. And the whole issue of health disparity is an incredibly important one. But it is to figure out for those people that are using up the really expensive services, the chronic and acutely ill people, what can we do, number one, to manage them in a way that gets them better results for less, and number two, keep people from sliding over into that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're paying more, but we're not getting better health care. And why is that?
I think it's because of the perverse payment system that we have in this country. You could assess blame. There's plenty to go around, but we have slip-slided into a system that, let's call it the fee-for-service system. We have a system right now that, because of ease of administration, if you do a thing, you get paid for it. Whether it's an office visit, whether it's an MRI, a CAT scan, an operation, a hospital, a day in the hospital, a medicine prescribed. And so, people are what they are, and doctors are incredibly highly motivated, very fine professionals that are trying to do the right thing in an environment that almost prohibits them from doing it. They do have families they have to support. They have kids going to college, et cetera. And they have to earn, in a very tough economic environment, an income. And right now the system forces them to do more things to earn the income that they need to survive. What we've got to do is we've got to change the payment system, and it's got to be gradually. You can't do it at once. But you've got to change the payment system over to something that rewards not just quality of care, because it's really not about quality of care. And I think, Renee understands this too. It's about results from the patient's standpoint. It's outcomes. And you know, the whole health disparity thing, too. From the patient's standpoint, it's about outcomes. It's not about whether people have checked the boxes and done the best practice. It's about getting well or staying well or getting range of motion back or living happy, productive lives. And we tend to forget that.
Mm. Renee, what do you think?
Right. So I totally agree that the fee-for-service system sort of detracts from focusing on what the health outcomes are for patients. I also agree that any change would have to be gradual. But I think the fee-for-service system, as Jim was saying, rewards specific things that healthcare providers do, the test ordered, the procedure performed. And but it doesn't adequately reward thinking. Sometimes, the internist, the primary care physician or the primary care provider, has to sort of sit down and look at the patient's situation. What are the test results showing? What does the patient want out of the situation? And think about what the right response is. And that doesn't get you paid in our, mm-hmm. In the same way in our fee-for-service system. So there needs to be a shift from that emphasis totally rewarding procedures and, more a shift to actually thinking and analyzing what the patient needs and what would produce the best outcomes. But Congress is always building. Medicare is a good example of, how difficult it is to change this dynamic because Congress is always putting setting fees, payment fees for, different categories of physicians and other kinds of services in the Medicare statute, and then setting deadlines for sort of gradual reductions or shifts from emphasis on one kind of provider, say surgeons, just to take a broad example, to internal medicine people. And then as the deadline approaches for those shifts to go into effect, because of, lobbying, understandable on the part of interest groups who will be adversely affected, very frequently the changes never happen. And so it's very difficult to make mm-hmm. these changes where it's seen as a zero-sum game, where some people will be losers and some people will be winners in the outcome of the process.
That's perfect. I've used that zero-sum game in one of my articles in Province Business News. The fee-for-service system is a zero-sum game. Somebody wins and somebody loses. And if Congress continues to focus on the fee, it's going to stay in that trap because they'll come up with the doc fix each year and they'll check it out at the end because you can't reduce the fees in this environment. So we've got to completely shift the paradigm to having a part or all of accountable care, multidisciplinary systems, be accountable for the care of assigned populations and measuring the health of those populations and having pay based upon moving the needle on the health of those populations. And to do that requires some hard pills to be swallowed by the American public. But it would be an answer to part of the questions that we have. The evaluative portion of physician practices is totally undervalued. Particularly you see that in primary care, where primary care doctors and behavioral health specialists have to sit and think about their patients, and they don't get paid for it. They get paid for the office visit. They get paid for doing things. Surgeons have it great. They operate. Then they send them back to the primary care doctor or the behavioral health specialist.
So,
I'm with you, Renee. You got it. But it's not just the evaluative. It's about the evaluative getting results.
Right.
And somehow we have to switch it over to that.
We are talking about healthcare reform with Jim your last name just went up. Jim Purcell. I'm sorry. Jim Purcell, former CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Rhode Island.
My mother would be proud.
And Professor Renee Landers, Director of Suffolk University Law School's Health and Biomedical Law Concentration. I guess a senior moment here. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about health care reform with Jim Purcell, former CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Rhode Island, who now facilitates the resolution of health care disputes, and Professor Renee Landers, director of Suffolk University Law School's Health and Biomedical Law Concentration. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So let's talk about some of the possible solutions that help reduce costs and improve our health care and hopefully make us healthier. One thing you just mentioned, Jim, was integrated systems of health care. And that's something that we're seeing a lot of the community health centers doing.
As we were talking about before the show, the community health centers, although they are perceived as being underfunded and way overstressed in terms of the number of people they have to handle, their healthcare outcomes actually typically are much better than your much glitzier, fancier hospital systems and specialists and primary care doctors get. One of the reasons for that is they integrate and co-locate a number of interdisciplinary types of delivery systems, such as primary care specialists, the glide path to the hospitals, and very, very importantly, mental health. And mental health is the unsung companion here that people tend to forget about when costs go up. But the co-location and integration of behavioral and physical health is a key component to better delivery of overall outcomes. You take the case of a 14-year-old pre-diabetic, obese, depressed girl. You cannot treat that young woman alone just by 4 visits a year to the primary care doctor. You need a combined plan that co-locates and integrates a behavioral health specialist, a primary care doctor, and more that deliver on an integrated fashion a result for this young woman. And to do that, they have to be paid for it. In today's environment, they're not.
Mm. Renee, what are your thoughts?
No, I agree that that is definitely part of the key to the solution is taking a look at the whole person and what are the sources, what are the things that are affecting their health status and their health outcomes. And I think Jim is right that we're only kind of at the beginning of trying to, really fully integrate behavioral health into the overall picture. And people who have behavioral health issues sometimes experience a substantial amount of discrimination or great difficulty in getting care for their physical ailments because of the behavioral health issues that mm-hmm. they present with. And so really having a place where people can go, where the whole person can be treated is really very important.
Sure. The behavioral health component here on the Cape, we have a particularly difficult time because of a shortage of behavioral health specialists. And, we're seeing in the substance abuse and the drug abuse issues, which are, of course, all interrelated, tremendous problems today. And if you look at the 5 top drug spends a health insurer spends on, 4 of the 5 are directly behavioral health related. And I include in that your statins for your cholesterol, your blood pressure medications. Those 2 are directly related to behavioral issues. Mm-hmm. Your SSRIs for your depression, and it goes on and on. And that is one way to do it. But again, it gets back to the way we pay for it. And I do think as well, one of the things the American public is going to have to get its arms around if we're going to address this is the disruptive nature of true reform if we're going to change the delivery system. Mm-hmm. I myself have been personally involved in trying to implement change by just nibbling around the fringe, such as getting pre-authorization for high-end imaging. And the screams of outrage from both the provider and the subscriber community are incredible, but in 1 year we saved $10 million because of, the sentinel effect of doctors knowing that they had to ask a specialist for permission to get an MRI or a CAT scan before mm-hmm. they ordered it. people got what they needed. But you have to be disruptive, and I think we are going to have to get to the issue of, and I'll say it, restrictive networks. Mm-hmm. For Hillary Clinton in the 90s, that was the third rail. They warned her, stay away from it because the American public hates it. But, and Renee, I'm sure you'd have a lot to say about this, but if we're going to hold accountable care organizations and multidisciplinary delivery groups accountable for the health of their cohort, they've got to control what doctors and nurses and hospitals see that cohort. So you can't let them wander outside the network, the high-quality network. And the American public is going to scream bloody murder about that. But I think that's going to have to be done someday if we can truly hold healthcare providers accountable for outcomes.
Well, so Zeke Emanuel had a piece in the New York Times on this very issue about restrictive networks just last week, where, you know, he talked about, you know, how that may, in fact, be necessary. But we have to build something into the structure so that people don't have the concern that they won't be getting the best care.
Yes.
And, and he had a number of suggestions about that, that we have standards about, mm-hmm. how robust these closed networks need to be in order to give people confidence that whatever happens to them, they will be taken care of appropriately. There needs to be transparency about how we're measuring these outcomes so that the public doesn't get the sense, well, if you get really sick, then we're going to try to pretend you're not part of our network anymore, and we're not going to take care of you and try to screen those numbers out. And then third, better ways of trying to, measure quality. I mean, we don't have good measures on a lot of things right now. And so we need a more robust approach to that. The Affordable Care Act has a lot of funding in the Medicare Centers for Innovation, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for Centers for Innovation. But it's we're not really there yet. And then finally, his last proposal was that, for people who have a really serious diagnosis, like cancer, something like that, some kind of out-of-network second opinion at the network cost that would be built into the system, so the person really would feel that they were getting the straight story on their healthcare status. So those kinds of things would go, I think, a long way toward giving people confidence that the system was working with their interests at heart.
I had a couple things popping in my head here. So in order for standard...
tell that you're...
Yeah. I'm like, okay, so in order for standard measures of care to succeed, as you're saying, this needs to be transparency. Patients would need to understand what the standards are. And I think many assume that insurance companies would base their standards on price.
Yes, in the 90s we did. My view... And I'm not sure how widely shared it is, but I think it's growing. Let's drop price out of the equation for the moment. I know that's a terribly important issue, but my belief is if we can focus on the quality and care and outcomes, price will follow. Mm. It will follow. So let's get away from the fee issue. Let's get away from the price issue for now and focus viciously, wicked hard, on price, on quality care and outcomes. And so on that basis, Renee, I love talking to you because you've got it. We can't do anything without agreed upon measures of quality care and outcome, because you can't measure them without having them. And they need to be physician and hospital based. In other words, they need to be done by the physicians and hospitals so that they can agree upon them. But how can we reward quality care and outcome without having agreed upon measures of quality care and outcome? And we don't even have them yet. Mm-hmm. That's the very first thing that has to happen. Then we need electronic medical records and a health information exchange to measure them. Then we got to pay based upon them. But if we have those measures, they've got to be published in the Boston Globe, in the Cape Cod Times, everywhere else. This has got to be right out there, and it's going to be awfully embarrassing to some hospitals and doctors. Mm. But we've got to publish them so that people see. We might publish the cost, but it's totally secondary. And if I'm building a network, I want to build it on quality care and outcome so that I can say, yes, you have to stay within this network, but guess what? This is the highest quality network that you can go. And I think there are benefit designs for your insurance that you can do that will help the primary care doctor keep you in the network. If you have a tiered system where the best quality doctor's a tier one, you can see somebody going into a primary care doctor's office and saying, well, the primary care doctor says, I want you to see Surgeon Smith. And you say, but my aunt said Surgeon Jones was really good. Well, let's see. Surgeon Smith is tier one. Surgeon Jones is tier three. You can see Surgeon Jones, but you've got a $2,000 deductible. If you see the high quality doc, you got a zero deductible. Now, what do you want? Mm. You know, now you start getting everybody aligned. And these doctors are competitive. They're not going to want to stay in tier three. They're going to do everything they can to improve their quality care and outcome to get into tier one. So now we've got competition at the right level. Hmm. And you expose it.
Yeah. Right. Excuse me. I'm sorry. No. So I think there's a sort of a trial of this kind of approach going on out in California now because the Kaiser health plan has, taken some routine standard procedures. You know, that a lot of people experience, you know, hip replacements, knee replacements, that kind of thing. Sort of attached kind of a price that it will pay for the service. You can go to any physician you want for that price. And if it costs more, then you have to, you know, it's between you and the physician about how you're going to take care of the difference between the price the insurer will pay and what the physician wants to get. And what's been happening, as I understand it, the things I've read about it, is that, a lot of the physicians and hospitals are matching the price of the insurers because they didn't set it at the lowest level. They set it at a very reasonable level. And because of market competition, the providers are going to take the payment in order to be able to see the patients. So that's the kind of thing that one can do to try to, encourage this sort of change.
One of the things we talked about earlier was access to healthcare. So if you live in a place where you can't get access to the higher tiered physicians or facilities, I mean, that could be an issue. And we have it's an issue now, access to quality healthcare.
Yep. And, but what about a system that if you're, you know, you're talking about results and moving the needle. Now you've got patient-centered medical homes for primary care or integrated delivery systems that think, hey, I've got this family that lives in an area that doesn't have access to health care. What am I going to do to get them access to health care so I can move the needle on them? Mm-hmm. So maybe they will find it overall better in order for them to move the needle to figure out a way to either come to them or to get them to come to the facility. All I'm saying is in the old days, because we didn't pay for it, nobody thought about it. Mm. But if you pay for outcomes, and I don't even mean best practice, I mean outcomes, now you turn it over to the providers to figure out, well, maybe we're in the business of transporting patients to our facilities who need it, because that will get us the outcomes we need. You change the paradigm from get away from the fee, get away from the cost for the moment, and get to what is the outcome that we want. You change the whole dynamic of the discussion. And I'm not suggesting it's easy. It's going to be very, very difficult. But the discussion has to move to that level.
So another example of that kind of thing is there's a movement called the Medical Legal Partnership, where a number of years ago now, pediatricians at Boston Medical Center, what's now Boston Medical Center, recognized that patients were coming in with kind of repeat intractable problems, childhood asthma, all kinds of different issues. And at the root of it, oftentimes was some legal issue, something that, a different discipline could resolve. So they started having, legal consultation available to patients on site. So maybe the lawyer could call and get the landlord to remove the shag carpeting or do something about rodent infestation that was, perpetuating the child's asthma, or solve an immigration issue or an access to Medicaid participation or something like that, so that the person could actually take the drugs they were prescribed. So that they're and that's, I think, an example of what Jim's talking about, is that the healthcare outcomes interact with a lot of others. Circumstances in a person's life, and to just say, well, we're only doing medicine here, is not going to produce the outcomes that medicine wants to achieve.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you have a comment or question. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about healthcare reform with Professor Renee Landers, Director of Suffolk University Law School's Health and Biomedical Law Concentration, and Jim Purcell, former CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Rhode Island. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number for your comments or questions. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, let's talk about the patients here for a moment and patient responsibility. What about these situations where physicians are doing all the right things, but patients are not heeding advice? They're not losing weight. They're not exercising. They're not changing their diet. There's got to be some patient responsibility here, right?
Yes. And of course, to be fair to the patients, as we just discussed, we have not given them the tools that they need in order to be responsible, which would be the quality of care and outcome measures for various physicians and hospitals and the cost so that they can make responsible choices on how to access the system. I think we've got to remedy that. But, yeah, we can talk about healthcare reform, but without patient responsibility reform, you've got one hand clapping here, and the other hand is really, really important. In terms of patient responsibility, it's really difficult, and there we can find lots of reasons why that is, such as educational disparity, the time and access to be able to understand these various things. But still, we have to do something to make non-compliance real to the patient. And I don't mean necessarily the impossibility of losing weight. I think many of us have tried for years to lose weight without success. But it doesn't mean that you can't try. It doesn't mean that you can't do things within your control. And if you don't, that you pay some sort of penalty. Corporal punishment is no longer permitted, and public humiliation is tacky. So I think the only way that we have to induce behavior here is financial in some sort. And the penalty word is not a popular word, but I think we have to do something that really makes it clear to patients that they bear a significant responsibility in this.
Renee?
Well, so I do think that people do have to have the attitude that they have to take some responsibility for their own health. I think it's very hard when we live in a culture where you just sit and watch an evening of television and see the ads that are coming at you about, mm-hmm. Fast food. And, if you do indulge in that fast food, there's a pill you can take that, will address some of the health effects of it. So the whole culture is not reinforcing the messages about healthy lifestyles that we need to inculcate. And so, one of the great things about our country is we have the First Amendment, so people can talk about, encourage people into all these less than healthy behaviors. And the bad news is that we have this First Amendment, and that the competition to get the healthy messages out is very difficult. So the Affordable Care Act does try to take this on a little bit by allowing insurers, employer-based health plans to offer incentives for people who do things like exercise, try to improve their diet, stop smoking, all these kinds of things. You can't tack the incentive to actually stopping smoking or losing a certain amount of weight or getting your blood sugar levels below a certain level or something like that. But you can reward the effort at this point under current law. And so that's a step in the right direction. I think that at the end of the day, There is a problem with making it harder for people who need the care, regardless of how they got in the situation of needing the care, making it harder for them to get the care. The copay situation, I think, ends up costing people with, quote unquote legitimate, but with, chronic illnesses that they can't do anything about other than try to treat them. It costs them more because of the copay situation. Mm-hmm. And, there's a problem there, I think, in the healthcare system. I don't think we've figured out what the right balance of incentives is, getting people mm-hmm. to have, the kind of skin in the game, but at the same time giving people the right access to care and so, not unduly penalizing them.
Right. Let's talk to Ellen, who's giving us a call from Dennis. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning. Great show. Couple things. One is, I'm not sure if the public all has gotten it, but the Cape Cod Hospital recently sent out this wonderful letter, and it's PR for sure, but there are measurable outcomes in the sense of they're in the top 10%, top 15%, top 100, and that's all good, but as most of the people work in healthcare know that between 60 and 75% of the healthcare money on Cape Cod comes from Medicare and a little bit from Medicaid, and that number is dropping. The fee reimbursement is dropping, and the local institution is pretty much near the top of where it can spread. The only way it can do it now is to beat back on staffing, and that has been a big problem, not necessarily brought to the forefront, but there's a state law about mandatory overtime. It can't be done, and yet any particular hospital floor probably has anywhere from 10 to 20 mandatory overtimes a week. And so there's a measurement of healthcare outcome by the people that take care of you, and that's not mentioned anywhere. I'd like to hear about that.
All right. Thanks, Ellen.
Yeah. Hospitals are terribly in harm's way. While, I think many of the things that have gotten us where we are because of what hospitals have done. Still, if you look at being a hospital today, they're in difficult straits. Medicare and Medicaid, which accounts for about 55% of their gross income, their fees are reducing and their patient population are increasing, and commercial insurers are reducing their rates, and the Accountable Care Act has targeted them, and they can't charge for readmissions and things like that. In terms of what, if we are taking costs out of the healthcare system, probably 2/3 of those costs are going to be jobs, which is a tough pill to swallow. I think Cape Cod Hospital and the Cape Cod Hospital system has done a remarkably good job, but now they're faced with some terrible choices in terms of what they get more efficient on and how they cut back. I think the nurse overtime issue is a very real issue, and it eats into quality of care, so they have to be careful about that. But it is a very difficult situation, and you've put your finger on it. Finding solutions for this is pretty tough.
Yeah. Renee, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, so the other thing is that in other countries, and I'm not saying nurses are in this category necessarily, but we really do have to think about who gets paid what in the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. I think in our country, and what are hospital executives paid? And I don't know enough about the Cape Cod situation, so this is not a comment about that. This is mm-hmm. a general comment. What are physicians paid, and then what is everybody else paid to deliver the care? And, if you pay people at the top end too much, the tendency is to cut jobs on the, on this care delivery side. And as Jim points out, that is, flirting with disaster in terms of the quality, and outcome measures. And so, I think we have to take a careful look at that. I mean, that's also a very kind of unpopular statement to make in a capitalist country, right? That maybe people could be satisfied with less and then more, and we need more people to work.
Yeah. Right, Jane is giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Okay. I guess what's missing from the program, I feel, Mindy, is the patient. Mm-hmm. Everybody's there from the echelons that don't include actually getting health care, and the patients here on Cape Cod should be telling you some of their war stories And I certainly have a lot of war stories myself.
I couldn't agree with you more, Jane. I think what I was hoping to try to get across was this isn't about healthcare. It's about outcomes from the standpoint of the patient. Mm-hmm. And what we really try to got to focus on here is understanding that this isn't about who gets paid what so much or what procedures are done or even the quality of care. But from the patient's standpoint, am I living a healthy, productive life? Am I getting the care I need? And am I able to access that care when I need it? Mm-hmm. The rest of this stuff, for most people like you and me, is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. I want to get the care I need when I need it, no more, no less, and I want to be able to afford it. And if we start from that focus, I agree with you, absolutely, Jane.
And,
that's got to be the focus.
Jane, that's why we have the phone calls, so the patients can call in. That's why we do, we open up the lines.
So we got to measure outcomes. Not necessarily some of the other things, because that's what you're interested. You want to have a good outcome for yourself.
Right. Well, the other thing is that we want to measure the patient's experience with care as well. Because Jim talked about, trying to, cut back on high-end imaging services and things like that. But, you talk to any number of patients who will tell you that they had trouble getting an X-ray, right, mm-hmm. for a bone that was broken.
Right.
Well, there was something wrong in the patient-physician interaction when that kind of thing happens. And so, they're on that care delivery side, sort of figuring out what kinds of things, I'm just fighting a cold myself, what kinds of things really make the patient-physician interaction or caregiver interaction successful so that the patient feels listened to and gets what they need. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that's a very, very important part of this conversation.
Right. All right, Patsy's calling from Brewster. Hi, Patsy.
Yes, hi. I think along with this discussion, this AARP bulletin, March, which discusses the fact that there is a website called MediBid, MediBid.com. It's an online service where doctors and facilities can bid for a patient's business. And this woman who was needed a total hip replacement balked at a local hospital's $45,000 quote for a two-day stay, and it didn't even include the surgeon's fee.
Oh, my goodness.
And she found another doctor whose bid she accepted for $13,000 for 90.
Well, that's a big difference from the $45,000. Jim, you know you've
Patsy, you've been reading the AARP bulletin, haven't you?
Yeah, that's what she just said.
It also says if you're over 75, probably avoid the colonoscopies too.
Yeah, so it's yeah. So
it's a good publication.
Yeah. That's, I guess she said, the March edition of AARP.
Right.
All right, Jim's calling from Nantucket. Hi, Jim.
Hi, yes, good morning. I'd like to hear Mr. Purcell talk about the need to tie physician and hospital reimbursement to outcomes, because I agree that fee-for-service is really the rope that's hanging our healthcare system. But mm-hmm. I don't think it's just about doctors and hospitals being motivated to provide unneeded services in order to amp up fees, because that ignores the just incredible cost of the regulatory burden of providing our healthcare services. I think health insurance companies, as well as government payers, but probably more so private and nonprofit health insurance companies, are at least as much to blame given the all the regulatory burden that they cause. Mr. Purcell bragged about his organization saving $10 million by requiring prior authorization for MRIs and CAT scans, but that number doesn't take into consideration the number of patients who were then forced to pay for those tests out of pockets, as well as the cost of the practices, hiring a $35 an hour nurse just to sit on the phone for 45 minutes to get a test approved. Nantucket's our little local hospital was built in the 50s, and we had something like 55 patient rooms and two or three administrative offices. Now the hospital has 15 beds for patients, and all the rest of the exam rooms have been converted to administrative and billing mm-hmm. offices just to get paid. Mm-hmm. So we need a system that is based on outcomes, but one that also removes completely this profit-motivated layer of regulation that kind of siphons money right off the top.
Jim, thanks for the call. Jim?
That was a lot of questions. The outcomes, I think we're, you and I are probably in agreement. The difficulty is getting the measures in place. And, of course, it's easier to measure quality care than outcome because outcome's a little bit subjective. But we can measure outcomes. It's just getting the measures in place and starting to do them. In terms of the high-end imaging, nobody had to go out of pocket. It was just a procedure. I agree with you, though. It did place additional costs on primary care doctors to have somebody call in. And the administrative costs associated with our very inefficient method of getting approvals and billing and collecting is nightmarish, and we should do something about it. I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that that feeds into the point I was making early on in the program about the overall administrative burden of the system. And I think that one thing perhaps the Affordable Care Act will lead to as we think about how products are marketed on the healthcare exchanges is really, you know, trying to get them into more standard formats so that they can be compared, so that the variations are not, you know, you want to have competition in the market and you don't want to stifle innovation, but you also want people to be able to understand what the product is. How much will the copay be? What kind of prior approvals will I need? I don't want that. I want a different kind of plan. I'm willing to pay a little more for that. So to be able to do that, and it will also reduce the burden on the providers in trying to understand the plans. But I mean, that is one of the reasons why other countries spend less than we do on healthcare, because they have a, you know, a national system, you know, there's none of this sort of figuring out the idiosyncrasies of an individual person's insurance policy at the time of delivery of care.
Renee, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I wonder if you could touch on some of the biggest misconceptions of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I had a student who was on a plane to from here to a conference in Dallas and a couple of months ago, and she's somebody who's been in healthcare for a long time and is now going to law school. She sat on a plane next to people who did not understand that that the Affordable Care Act prevented discrimination on the basis of pre-existing conditions, thought that the Affordable Care Act eliminated a prohibition on that, and so that there're just some very fundamental basic misunderstandings about you know, what some of the benefits of the statute will be. It is not perfect, that is for sure, and no big government program is perfect. I mean, every year there are thousands of pages of new statutes sort of tweaking Medicare and Medicaid here and there, and those programs have been around for nearly 50 years now. So, you know, it's very hard to get a complex thing like this right the first time, but you have to start somewhere. And you know, and I think that the, you know, and also I think another big misconception is that, you know, it actually is a problem for all of us as a country when people, when a substantial portion of the population does not have health insurance, because they're, that creates a tremendous barrier to receiving care and actually puts off getting care until a problem is much more serious and much more expensive for the person and society to solve. And that there's something that's not right about that. It's not right economically, and it's not right sort of as a moral proposition for a country like ours, I think.
Mm-hmm. 10 seconds for last word.
All right. I think the Accountable Care Act is, on balance, a very good thing. I've heard it cartoonized, but any country that does not provide access to 100% of its population to quality health care is not civilized.
Jim.
And I think to the extent it's done that, it's trying to do that, and it does it, I'm for it.
Jim Purcell, former CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Rhode Island, who is now facilitates the resolution of healthcare disputes, and also Professor Renee Landers, director of Suffolk University Law School's Health and Biomedical Law Concentration. Thank you both so much for being here this morning.
No, thank you for having us.
Thank you very much. It was an interesting conversation.
Great. And thanks to John Parker for engineering assistance in Boston. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.